birthday! Birthday!
On Monica Tom, in his stolen red sash uniform, drew not even one second glance as he cheered himself hoarse while watching Ryan and what looked to be his twin getting hustled away. Ryan Carter was noosed front and rear. The prisoner beside him was similarly bound. From a distance, the second man might have been Ryan's twin brother. Tom had no doubt what was going on. He just witnessed a show trial with a verdict that had already been decided. What, if anything, Ryan could have done to deserve this was a mystery to him. Had Carter committed some kind of crime against piracy while a prisoner on the Matachine Tug? Had he started a mutiny or a slave rebellion? The seagoing trader accepted a half-full glass bottle that was shoved into his chest and pretended to take a deep swig from it. Pretended because the backwash from a dozen strangers did not appeal to him in the least. Then he passed the joy juice on, wiping his mouth with the back of his hand. When the opportunity arose to do a little wreck of the fort's interior, knowing that's where Carter and the others had been taken the previous night, Tom Wolfe had seized it without a moment's hesitation. Killing a red sash and taking his clothes had been dead easy. Based on his wreck of the night before, blowing up the power plant looked like it was going to be a piece of cake. He figured if Ryan and his companions were still alive this morning and he could pinpoint the location where they were being held, there was a chance he could rescue them in the chaos that was sure to come after he turned off the lights. At least he could try to rescue them. Considering who they were and what they had endured, considering he had been instrumental in getting them into this mess in the first place, he owed them that much. 2 hours in the broiling sun, pretending to be jubilant, was a small price to pay. The look-alike hadn't acted like a prisoner, despite the chains. He'd held himself proudly erect, and he turned from side to side, addressing the enemies that packed both sides of the battlements. He was defiant, unbroken, unrepentant, even though he was helpless and, it would seem, doomed. Tom found the reaction of the militiamen milling around him very strange. It was obvious that they considered the condemned man a threat larger than life, even under these circumstances. All the red sashes, Tom included, rushed to the opposite side of the battlements. Ryan and his mirror image reappeared almost directly below them, hustled as fast as their ankle chains would allow onto the footbridge and toward a windowless, gray, stone-block building that squatted on a shaved flat atoll of coral. Bottles shattered on the bridge's stone rails and splashed into the water on either side. When shotguns started booming along the battlements, Tom winced, but the discharges were aimed at the canal, not the condemned. The crowd continued to celebrate even after the entourage disappeared safely through the arched portal of the prison. The militiamen actually believed they had just won a victory for their side. At least now he knew where Ryan was being held, and he had a rough idea how many hours he had left to figure out a way to free him. After a bit, the red sashes settled down and started filing out of the fort. Tom went with the flow, accepting countless backslap congratulations. After he crossed the bridge, he stepped out of the flow of the mob, which was headed back toward Veracruz to prepare for the execution, and walked around the edge of the stone quay. The channel between the fort and the prison looked deep enough for Tempest's keel, but because of the connecting footbridge and the height of his ship's masts, it had to be a motor-in, back-out situation, and the necessary left turn was very tight for a 40-foot sloop. In the dark and in a hurry, there was a big risk, if not a likelihood, of grounding the ship in the attempt. Tom completely circled the Ravelin on the peninsula side, confirming the fact that there was just one way in and one way out, through the arched portal on the far side of the footbridge. A tough nut to crack, particularly if he wanted to get away with a whole skin. Christie's body was simultaneously pressed into the bunk bed mattress and jolted by a muffled impact. In the back of her mind, she knew something important had changed. Something was wrong. Then she realized the constant rumble of the black ship's diesel had disappeared. They were under sail. Christie forced her eyelids open, then with an effort, focused on her surroundings. There were no windows in the cabin she shared with Mildred. The walls were featureless sheet steel. The only light came from a caged bulb in the center of the ceiling. Rising groggily to her feet, Christy shook Mildred's shoulder, but the woman was out cold on the upper bunk.
Mildred?
Mildred slowly opened her eyes. As the ship climbed the back of a wave, Christy's legs suddenly went weak in the knees, and her head started to spin.
Whoa.
She steadied herself by gripping the edge of Mildred's bunk. What she was feeling made no sense. Christy had been stuck on board ship for many weeks and had been exposed to the elements in a variety of unpleasant sea and wind states. She was accustomed to the rolling motion and the violent wave impacts. She knew whatever it wasn't seasickness. This sensation was entirely different. She wasn't sick to her stomach. Her mind and her coordination were what was impaired. Her thinking muddled, her limbs tangle-footed. It was all she could do not to creep back into her bunk and pull the covers over her head. Clinging to the bed frame, Christy realized with a shock that she had no idea how much time had passed since she and Mildred had crawled into their respective bunks. Time was the vital element. Ryan's life depended on it. The last thing she remembered was breakfast, although she couldn't recall how long ago that had been. She and Mildred had been served tall, hot stacks of golden brown pancakes, drizzled with melted butter and some kind of sweet brown syrup, with separate bowls heaped with crisp strips of bacon. She remembered how good the food had smelled and tasted. She had been so hungry. Barely awake, she had gobbled it down, hand over fist. Mildred had attacked her food with the same enthusiasm. They had eaten like starving animals. Now Christy was hungry again. Her stomach's complaints were her only gauge of the elapsed time. 3 hours to digest? Maybe four? Could it be past noon already? Mildred pushed up to a wobbly sitting position on her bunk, bracing herself against the impacts with a hand pressed to the cabin wall.
The diesel has stopped.
Sounds and feels like we've picked up some real speed. They must have all the sheets up.
How long have we been running with the wind? How long have we been asleep?
I don't know. I just woke up.
Oh, God. Oh.
Mildred let her face fall into her manacled hands.
What is it?
The wind's hard behind us now, don't you see? No matter how far south we've come, to retrace our route and return to Veracruz, we're going to have to beat back against it. We're going to have to zigzag, tacking back and forth the whole way. It'll take us twice as long to cover the same ground, maybe longer.
This is the end of everything. This is the end of us.
We've got to go back after him. No matter how long it takes to get there, we've got to take over this ship and go back for him.
Christy just stared at her, the tears still falling freely.
You can't grieve over a death that hasn't happened yet. You're letting your exhaustion get the better of you. You've got to keep fighting it. We all have to. Until we go back and see for ourselves, we won't know whether they really killed him or not. Anything is possible. We can't count Ryan out. Not ever. No matter the odds.
I know that.
He wasn't counting on our help to get away.
I know that, too.
We have to focus all our attention on turning the ship around. That's our goal. And to reach it, first we've got to get out of these shackles.
You're right. Of course you're right. Oh, God damn it. Mildred, why am I feeling so dizzy? Why am I so hungry?
I don't feel so great either. And I could eat my own boot sole right now if I had something to cut it up with. It's probably just a side effect of the starvation. We've been without full rations for weeks while rowing our butts off. All of a sudden, we're eating our fill and doing nothing. Our bodies don't know how to react to the change. That, plus the accumulated exhaustion and stress, mixed in with the roll of a strange ship. Ugh. I think whatever it is, it'll pass quickly.
It better happen soon.
A wave impact slammed Christy's hip bones against the edge of the bunk, hard. Since she had gotten out of bed, there had been a distinct change in the ship's movement. The yaw and pitch of the deck had become more extreme, the vibrations of the hull as it slammed into wave troughs much stronger. The seas were getting bigger, steeper, more jumbled. The weather was definitely worsening. Then the cabin's door bolts clacked back. The door swung open, revealing the two female whitecoats. They stood in the corridor, their short legs braced against the roll of the deck, swaying back and forth as they bore trays of food. They were grinning to beat the band, white teeth, sparkling black eyes, so happy. They stepped into the cabin and uncovered the plates they carried, releasing trapped, spicy, and oh-so-enticing aromas. The meal consisted of some kind of shredded meat, beef or pork, rolled up in corn tortillas and smothered in a deep red sauce and melted gobs of white cheese. On the side of the plate was a big dollop of squashed-up beans, again topped with melted cheese. Mildred accepted the plate and fork they handed up to her bunk. The smell of the food close up made Christy's mouth water. She couldn't hold herself back. She and Mildred scraped the metal plates with the edges of their forks to get the last drops of sauce and melty cheese. The white coats poured them cups of water to wash it down with. Mildred looked at them.
Excuse me, but where are we going? When will we get there? How far is it?
The women just smiled serenely. Maybe they were under orders not to speak to us, Christy thought. Then her mind turned to other, more important things. She and Mildred needed to open their wrist and ankle cuffs. That was the first order of business. To do that, they needed a tool, something to pick the lock with, something metal. As Christy stacked the licked, clean plates on top of each other, she managed to sneak out her fork and slip it up her sleeve. The merry little white coats didn't seem to notice the missing utensil when they took away the plates and cups. Christy waited until they had closed and locked the door from the outside before showing Mildred the prize.
Look,
that just might do it.
Needs a bit of a minor adjustment first.
Christy used the face of the steel bed frame to carefully bend three of the tines over and out of the way, forming a makeshift lockpick with the fourth.
Let me jump down off here. If I sit on your bunk, it'll give you a better angle, and I can hold my feet flat on the bed. It should make it easier for you to work.
Mildred climbed down and hopped onto the lower bunk. Christy sat on the edge of the bed and poked around inside the keyhole. Mildred's eyes slowly closed, and her head dropped to her chest. When her chin hit her breastbone, she woke up quickly.
Oops, conked out there for a minute.
Are you okay?
Yeah. I just need to get a little more comfortable.
Mildred adjusted a pillow behind her back. In seconds, Mildred was sound asleep. Christy kept working on the lock, but to no avail. It got harder and harder to find the pressure point inside the mechanism. She worked until she was too sleepy to concentrate. Then she had to stop. And when she did, she too almost immediately fell asleep. Christy realized she was on the verge of passing out. She had the presence of mind to hide the fork inside the top of her boot before that happened. She looked up at the top bunk. It might as well have been Mount Everest. No way could she make it up there. Christy crawled in beside Mildred on the narrow mattress, and the moment she closed her eyes, she was dead to the world.
They sure do love you.
They are my people, and they love me, but they don't really know. They only know my legend, the myth I created. They are in love with the man I fashioned out of smoke.
Sounds like you did a hell of a job.
No, it wasn't me who made it happen. My people gave it substance because they needed so badly for it to be true. We have endured far too much, for far too long at the hands of the Utterpool dynasty. I supplied the hope. They put the flesh on it and pumped it full of blood.
Ryan figured they'd been back in the cell 5 or 6 hours, which meant it had to be getting on to evening outside. His thoughts returned to Christy, JB, Doc, Mildred, and Jack, dragged off to who knew where for who knew what. Chucho nudged him with an elbow and produced a sliver of bone about 2 inches long.
Let me see to your shackles.
If you take them off me now, the red sashes are bound to notice.
Don't worry. I'll show you.
With deft flicks of the pick, Chucho unlocked Ryan's wrist and ankle cuffs. For the first time in weeks, Ryan was able to take a stride longer than 2 feet. He paced the width of the damp cell floor, stretching his legs.
Oh, holy shit. I can't tell you how good this feels.
Now we have to put them back on.
Chucho lifted the hem of the cloth wrapped around his waist and teased out a bunch of the 4-foot-long threads. He closed the cuffs back around Ryan's ankles and secured them in that position with winds of thread that in the dim light were almost invisible. Outside, at night, they would be invisible. Chucho did the same with the wrist cuffs.
When you want the shackles to come off, just pull the chains between them tight and the threads will break. Be careful, though. Don't stretch the chains too much when they're walking us out of here. We don't want them to fall away before we're ready to make our move.
Are they coming for us now?
No, the red sashes are bringing the condemned their last meal. Our fellow prisoners can smell the goodies. That's why they're making such a fuss.
Must smell pretty damn good, then.
Compared to raw rat butthole, anything smells good.
Four red sashes approached the outside of the cell. One held a pair of big ceramic bowls, one held a pair of glass bottles, two carried scatter guns. The gunners poked their shouldered weapons through the bars, giving the food bearers cover as they unlocked and opened the door and set the trays on the floor. Ryan did a visual inventory from the far side of the cell. Whole roasted chickens, potatoes, maybe tomatoes, some other vegetables, and beakers of something red to drink, probably wine. After leaving the food within reach, the red sashes backed out of the cell and shut and relocked the door. They didn't stick around to watch the condemned eat. They left without uttering a word. Ryan could smell the food from 10 feet away, and it smelled wonderful. He wasn't the only one who caught wind of it. As soon as the food bearers took their leave, dozens of rats came hipping and hopping down the corridor. They milled anxiously just beyond the bars, wanting to rush in and have it, but they were afraid of the light and the prisoners inside. Ryan hadn't eaten for a very long time. He hadn't eaten well for even longer. He made a beeline for the food before the rats summoned up the necessary courage. With his bare hands, he ripped a leg and thigh from one of the chicken carcasses, and with the juices running down his forearm, was about to stuff most of it into his mouth when Chucho grabbed his arm.
Don't eat it. What? Because they spit in it? Who gives a damn?
No. They added las opiatas, morfina, drugs to make us weak as kittens, so we don't try to escape, and so we don't fight so hard when they torture us.
Fucking fire blast.
Ryan tossed the untouched chicken back into the bowl in disgust.
I figured they'd want us screaming in pain. Screaming is always a big crowd pleaser.
Oh, we would still scream. We'd scream our heads off. The drugs don't stop a person from feeling pain. You still feel everything they do to you. You just can't do anything about it. It makes the victims easier for the executioners to move around, like meat puppets with lungs.
Chucho used a foot to nudge the bowls even closer to the bars until they were actually touching them. Then he backed away. He motioned for Ryan to move with him to the rear of the cell. Sensing their opportunity, the bravest of the rats moved in. In a minute or two, they were eating in a competitive frenzy, and their fellows, in droves, were scampering down the corridor to join them. It didn't take long. Ryan watched as rats started falling over, one by one. The growing mass of the fallen didn't stop those behind from sampling the food. Soon, the bowls and a surrounding section of stone floor were covered by a pile of furry, unconscious bodies. Chucho approached Ground Zero, which sent the still-hungry survivors scurrying out of the cell and down the hall. He started gathering up the rats, two by two. Using threads from his garment, he securely tied their tails together and then flipped them back out in the corridor. He worked quickly, giving the impression this was not the first time he had pulled the trick. He cinched his knots tight, making a critter with 8 legs and 2 heads, legs and heads pointing in the opposite direction.
When they wake up, won't they be surprised? They won't be able to bite their tails off to escape. To get away, they'll try to kill one another. If one of them succeeds, it will have to drag the corpse of the other behind it.
Okay. So, when is our execution going to happen?
Who knows? Things never happened on time here, even before the Matachin showed up. The Red Sash traitors are very disorganized. There is too much to be done in preparation, and they are probably still busy drinking to get up their courage to watch us die. They have to set up security along the parade route.
But if they take us to the city in separate trucks, it'll make escape much more difficult.
They won't do that. 2 trucks would be harder to protect. More work.
Are they coming back for the plates?
I don't think so. Listen. I think it's time. They are coming for us. We have to pretend we're drugged. Keep your head down and don't make any fast movements. Keep to the shadows as much as you can. Do whatever they tell you, but do it slowly.
With that, Ryan's double picked up the remaining food and dumped most of it into the cell's toilet, a rusting, galvanized bucket full of piss. He poured the wine into the bucket too, then put the empty bowls and bottles back in plain sight. Ryan stood gripping the cell's bars, looking down the low-ceilinged hall. He could see the execution detail approaching. The priests were in the lead, all eight of them, swaying in unison as they shuffled along under the weak electric light. Some of them swung incense burners beside their ankles. Behind them was Modo, and behind him was a contingent of Red Sash guards. They came to a halt outside the cell. The Governor General of Veracruz stepped forward, stopping at the other side of the bars. Despite Chucho's warning to stay back, Ryan stood his ground. He did half-close his eye and pretended to be using the bars to hold himself upright. As he had earlier in the day, Generalissimo Almodo wore the white uniform. He was also carrying a gold-scabbarded, pearl-handled saber with pommel tassel. The corridor's stark lighting made the deformations of his face seem all the more exaggerated and horrifying. Ryan assumed the oral surgery had done something untoward to his salivary glands. Modo was drooling between his golden fangs. Long strands of clear slime swayed off his chin. Up close, the general's eyes radiated something that struck Ryan as very strange. It was like some other kind of creature was looking out at him. Something alien, perhaps not of this earth. Something that had traveled to places where human beings were never supposed to go, and done things there that human beings were never supposed to do. At Modo's signal, the priests advanced. Keeping well back from the bars, the men in the pointed hats and bleeding veils began their ritual, which consisted of a shuffling line dance and the fanning of incense into the doomed men's cell. To Ryan, it smelled like burning hair. He stepped back from the pall of noxious smoke, moving slowly as Chucho had suggested. He moved to the rear wall, beside his cellmate.
What the fuck are they doing?
They are preparing us for sacrifice to the outer pools. This is the priest's purifying ritual.
How about giving us a purifying bath?
It's a spiritual cleansing. It doesn't require soap and water. We don't smell too bad compared to the Matachin.
Yeah, they work hard at it.
Amid the clouds of burning hair smoke, the spider priest, its Amna, whipped out a clutch of pale tubular objects. Ryan nudged Chucho.
They're bird quills plucked from sea eagles' wings.
Ryan estimated they were 10 inches long and a quarter inch in diameter. Itzamna leaned down, stuck his head next to the nearest sensor, sucked in a mouthful of smoke, then puckered up and blew it through one of the quills. The smoke didn't just come out the far end. It also seeped out through a series of holes drilled along the top of its length.
He's blessing the pointed instruments they're shortly going to push crosswise through our limp digs. The holes they've drilled allow the blood to drip into the hollow tube and out the lower end. They'll smear the collected blood on parchment and burn it in a sacred pot for the Lords of Death. Since they are far away in Xibalba, they won't be present in spirit or flesh at our executions, so the priests are sending them an offering and an announcement of the proceedings they can smell and taste.
When the priests finished, Modo stepped forward. Ryan noticed that the Governor General's drooling had taken on epic proportions. The threads of slobber trailed more than 2 feet from his chin, their globular ends swinging back and forth like pendulums. The glistening strands were absolutely mesmerizing. The more Modo talked, the longer they grew. The Governor General looked like a ravening beast. Had the Lords of Death made him so? Was it a requirement of the office he held? And how exactly had they managed to make the changes without killing him in the process? Some arcane, pre-dark white coat sleight of hand, no doubt. Ryan imagined more man-beasts just like him, sitting atop each of the thrones of the other subject city-states. Moving a jaw and face so distorted had to involve constant, perhaps excruciating, discomfort. The upper and lower jaws couldn't be closed because of the size and position of the artificial fangs. A grotesque price to pay for power. Modo raised his hand, and the music stopped.
I represent the civil authority of Veracruz. My power is granted directly from the God of Gods, the Great One himself. Atapul the Tenth, who has ordained a proper punishment for the numerous crimes of which you have been convicted. Atapul the Tenth, who controls the great city-states, who controls the navies, who controls the seas of plague, who is responsible for all human suffering, who takes that suffering as his due, who considers human beings to be his personal playthings. And you, Jojo, you have been a thorn in the side of order and civilization for too long. The world is going to be a better place without you. And I will have justice for all the Rensashes and the priests you have killed.
However, the tirade didn't have any noticeable effect on Chucho. Ryan was surprised by that. He half expected an angry outburst from his double. But Chucho held both his tongue and his temper. He winked at Ryan. At an imperious wave of Modo's hand, a red sash pulled out a ring of keys and unlocked the cell door. This, while five other traitors held Ryan and Chucho at blaster point. The noose-bearers stood at the ready as the door creaked back.
On your knees!
Chucho glanced at Ryan, who shrugged.
Sure, why not?
Ryan and his look-alike dropped meekly to the stone floor. The noose-bearers advanced into their cell with extreme caution. Holding the poles like lances out in front of them, they approached the chained and kneeling men. As the nooses were extended above their heads, Modo's tongue ran obscenely over his fangs.
Time to start the dying.
Harmonica Tom squeezed back through the slit in the power plant's rusting hurricane fence, careful not to catch his bill cap, poncho, or backpack on the ragged edges of the mesh. It was much easier slipping out than it had been slipping in, because over the course of half an hour, he had considerably lightened his load. Behind him, in separate parcels scattered throughout the plant's generator room, the tank farm, and the step-up station, he had left close to 70 pounds of prepped, primed, and ready-to-rip plastic explosive. Only about 20 pounds of the stuff remained in the pack on his back. As he'd anticipated, the job had been a cinch. A plant worker was walking between the rows of 90,000-gallon fuel tanks as he was walking the other way. This, shortly after he'd mined the base of an oil reservoir with 5 pounds of C4. He and the hard hat had passed each other with a nod and a wave. The worker hadn't even looked back. Spread out ahead of him, Tom could see the parade route leading from the illuminated fort to the glowing city. It was marked by pools of light thrown by the peninsula's mercury vapor lamps. The vibrant radiance of Veracruz reflected off the solid, low overcast of the sky. The night was moonless and starless, practically made to order for what he had in mind. Along the waterfront, the city's lighthouse was ablaze with red color spotlights. Because he'd done a quick wreck before sunset, he knew it was going to be the venue for the executions. Grandstands had been set up in the middle of the road for high-ranking spectators. From what he'd gathered on the back streets and in the alleys, the mood of the common people of Veracruz was nothing short of dread. Away from the scrutiny of red sashes and priests, their jubilation transformed into anger and sorrow. Expressing displeasure or alarm over the upcoming festivities was dangerous. While loitering on the street, Tom had overheard a mother warning her quartet of wide-eyed, knee-high children not to cry over the fact that their beloved Chucho was scheduled to die that night. The daylight wreck gave Tom his first real understanding of the plight of these people and their relationship to the Marachin. They were victims, as much as his fellow Deathlanders on Padre Island. They had been terrified into passivity. Even though they outnumbered the Red Sashes 1,000 to 1, they allowed themselves to be dominated and exploited by them. For reasons that were not obvious to Tom, they had convinced themselves that they couldn't fight this enemy and win. He hurried back to the Tempest, not dwelling on the damage he was about to do to the local infrastructure that would cause them all to suffer. Maybe it would give them a chance to break free. but they were foreigners, strangers to him. Whether that was the ultimate outcome of the demolition job was not his particular concern. His countrymen and women were locked up in that stone shithole of a prison. His people were dead and left unburied on Padre Island, food for the flies, rats, and gulls. To pay back an unspeakable evil, a lesser evil had to be committed. It took him 15 minutes of fast walking to reach Tempest. Tom climbed onto the deck and moved through the forward companionway and retrieved a loaded ballistic nylon duffel from a locker. On the foredeck, before he set the bag down inside the ship's dinghy, he opened the zippered pocket and took out a Petzl headlamp, which he slipped over the crown of his bill cap. He then swung out the dinghy on its davit, lowered it into the water, and climbed in. Sitting on the thwart seat with his back to the bow, Tom dipped his oars and began rowing slowly along the shore, past the ruined piers, toward the ancient fortress. The rafted-up rows of small commercial vessels were deserted. The only people he saw on the streets beyond were hurrying away for the parade or the big show in the city. When he glanced over his shoulders to check his progress, he could see the fort was lit up. The towering battlements looked as white as bone in the hard glare of the spotlights. He rowed close to the stone quay east and opposite the main complex. Other boats were moored there, tied up to the end of the surviving pier and to each other. They, too, were deserted. As he eased around the last of the boats into the protected water in the lee of the fort, there were no challenges from the ramparts, even though he was in plain view and he could see the heads and shoulders of men moving around up there. He figured the fort's sentries were too occupied with other duties, or too drunk in celebration to notice or care about one guy in a dinky little rowboat. Tom knew that most of the Red Sashes were 3 miles away in the city, manning the security detail for the executions. Plenty far enough away so they couldn't interfere with his plans. That's where most of the civilians were, too, where in a few minutes it would be pitch black. What would happen there in the dark when the Red Sashes were surrounded by the people they had been abusing, when there was no one taking down names? Come daybreak, it wouldn't just be paper heads on poles lining the streets, and the new heads would be wearing straw hats. Looking over his shoulder, Tom steered the dinghy deeper into the little embayment, toward the edge of the channels that formed saltwater moats around the 3-story main fort and the story smaller prison block. Down the narrow central canal, which was bracketed on either side by stone battlements, he could see the footbridge that led to the dungeon. It was 200 feet away. Close enough. Tom stopped rowing, shipped his oars, unzipped the duffel, and took out the remote detonator. While the dinghy drifted, he carefully stood and pointed the device in the direction of the power plant. He could see its lights on the horizon, above and between the roofs of the peninsula's warehouses. Tom flipped off the safety. When the flash faded, it was lights out. The only light that survived was from scattered wag head and tail lights and a lot of fire. Flames hundreds of feet high raged in the tank farm, but they didn't illuminate anything past the plant's perimeter fence. The glorious city had vanished into a field of impenetrable, velvety black. Tom sat back down in the dinghy. Having taken his bearings just before the lights went out, he unshipped the oars and began rowing down the center canal for the footbridge. As he made for the fort end of the bridge, Tom smelled the oil smoke that was pouring from the tank farm, driven by a slight breeze across the peninsula. Overhead, he felt a looming presence. He reached up with the tip of an oar and tapped something made of stone. He was directly under the footbridge, and therefore out of view of both the fort and the prison. Even if they had portable spotlights close to hand. When the bow of the dinghy scraped against the stone pillar, he stopped rowing and turned on his headlamp for a second. long enough to unzip the duffel and take out a hunk of C4 and the detonator rigging. He slapped the charge on the bridge's support and primed it. Then he shut off the headlamp and rode under the bridge, along its length, to the opposite end. He hopped out of the boat and onto the prison island's quay.
Shit. Where's that coming from?
It could have come from Veracruz or from inside the prison. He couldn't tell which. No one had crossed the bridge above him, not from the fort or the prison. The sudden blackout appeared to have, at least for the moment, paralyzed his opposition. After securing the dinghy with the H&K machine pistol in his right fist, duffel slung over his left shoulder, Tom felt his way along the front of the prison to the arched portal of the entrance. He flicked on his headlamp again to locate the door latch, then quickly shut it off. When he tried to open the door, he found it was bolted from the inside. Tom pulled another chunk of plastique from the duffel, packed it into the door jamb, and inserted the trigger and blasting cap. Across the canal, along the fort's ramparts, a few lights were appearing here and there. They were weak, and for sure they weren't battery-powered flashlights. Lanterns and kerosene burners, Tom guessed. Accordingly, there was no focus or penetration of the light they cast, just a ring of illumination around the lantern bearers. The thickening smoke coming from the tank farm didn't help the situation either.
That's right, you sons of bitches. Panic time.
Tom retreated back along the prison's front wall to a little alcove he had noted earlier in the day. He crouched, facing away from the blasts, ducked his head, and once again hit the remote detonator's boom button. The massive prison door blew off its hinges and slammed into the bridge's decorative columns. Tom's ears were still ringing when he turned on his headlamp and ran for the prison entrance. A torrent of dust and smoke poured from the gaping hole where the doorway had once been. Without pause, he rushed through the entrance, the silenced H&K up and ready to rip. As he stepped across the threshold, even he was taken aback at how rad blasted dark it was inside. The Petzl headlamp's powerful beam couldn't pierce the swirling smoke and dust, which was so thick it was hard for him to breathe. It occurred to him that maybe he had used a little too much plastique. As Tom moved deeper, the dense clouds began to thin and dissipate. There was no way of telling how many red sashes were inside the anteroom before he blew the door. But looking around, he could tell no one was alive. Red sashes were in large pieces on the floor, or their still bodies were covered with blood. The explosion had caused huge sections of the limestone block ceiling to spall off, crushing whoever was unlucky enough to be standing beneath.
Damn.
The concentrated stink that rose from the floor, walls, and oppressively low ceiling was unreal. The dimpled, sweating limestone wall on his left reflected greasily in the light of the headlamp. The rock had been polished and oiled by thousands upon thousands of palms sliding over it. Out of the darkness beyond the 40-foot penetration of the Petzl's beam, four red sashes staggered forward. As they stepped into the light, he saw their faces were covered in white dust. They held their arms outstretched like blind men, then shielded their eyes to block the painful glare. Tom didn't slow down. Tom walked past the twitching bodies, straining his eyes and his ears for some sign of Ryan and the others. Huddled at the foot of the left-hand wall, he came across a pair of priests in red robes and tall, conical hats. They cowered there, kneeling in a shallow pool of piss. They appeared to be unarmed. They, too, were coated in rock dust. Moving closer, he recognized one as the spider-bellied bastard who'd read the execution order for Ryan and his double.
Problem solved.
A little farther on, Tom came to a fork off the main corridor, a left-branching hallway. His headlamp beam swept over and into the first of a long bank of cramped cells. On the other side of the floor-to-ceiling bars, he saw a filthy, nearly naked human figure. The whites of the man's eyes shone for an instant, radiating terror, before they squinted shut. Two eyes shining back told him it wasn't Ryan. Tom looked into the next cell. There was a heap of rags on the floor, a bare foot with a grime-encrusted sole stuck out from under it.
Ryan?
No answer, no movement. Farther down the dank hallway, beyond the range of the headlamp, and from deeper in the dungeon around him, the survivors' clanking of their chains told Tom approximately where they were. Tom had no idea how many prisoners were caged in the pitch dark, but he had to locate his targets and get them the hell out before things deteriorated even more. There was no time to go up and down the labyrinthine passages, searching for Ryan and the others cell by cell. He didn't have a map, and getting lost was not an option. Rather than shout Ryan's name down the cell blocks as he walked the main passage, something that he knew would certainly draw dozens, if not hundreds, of affirmative replies from the other prisoners hoping for rescue, he had a better idea. A signal only Ryan would recognize. Tom reached into his hip pocket and took out his harmonica with his left hand while he held the H and K up and ready in his right. The noose hung suspended 2 feet above Ryan's head as he knelt on the floor beside Chucho. The one-eyed warrior strained to hold himself in check as the red sash pole bearer began to lower the garrote on a stick. There was no doubt in his mind that the noose pole was another of the Matachin's inventions. It smacked of their brutal ingenuity. Strangulation at a distance of 5 feet was the perfect way to control prisoners who had nothing left to lose. Unconsciousness was just a cord pull away. Then the lights went out. Suddenly, it was darker than dark.
Now, Chucho!
Ryan and Chucho snapped the threads that held their heavy wrist and ankle cuffs in place, but neither man tossed the manacles aside. Instead, they gripped them by the middle of their connecting chains, turning the restraints instantly into wicked, close-range offensive weapons. Great minds thought alike. Shifting his brace of chain link and heavy steel bands to his left hand, Ryan found and grabbed hold of his double's wrist. No explanation was necessary. Chucho, in turn, locked his fingers around Ryan's wrist. Not just twins anymore, but conjoined twins. Thus connected, they couldn't lose each other in the dark, and they wouldn't hit each other by accident. As one, the two men rose from their knees, windmilling their manacles as they rushed forward toward the open cell door. Ryan's cuffs immediately thumped into someone. On his right, Chucho was doing the same to his own noose bearer. Hot blood, presumably from a head wound, sprayed over the side of Ryan's face and neck as the other pole man collapsed. In his mind, Ryan had locked in the last known position of Modo relative to the cell's exit. In 2 quick strides, his left shoulder was brushing against the edge of the iron door jamb. He pulled Chucho through the doorway and out into the corridor.
Fuego! Fuego, kill him!
Modo's red sash scatter gunners didn't pause to consider that they were friendlies in the line of fire. That's how afraid of Chucho they were. They cut loose blindly into the blackness, shooting their weapons from the hip. Double muzzle flashes lit up the inside of the cell, ears ringing, the acrid smell and taste of burned gunpowder filling his nose and mouth. Ryan turned in Modo's direction. As he did so, he ran headlong into a red sash on his left. Modo's red sashes struggled to reload their weapons in absolute darkness while retreating under toe-to-toe attack. Meanwhile, with Chucho in tow, Ryan had zeroed in on where he thought Modo was. Draping the brace of chains over the wrist of left hand, Ryan lunged forward with his right, fingers outstretched, searching for a grip on a soft, vulnerable throat. Instead, they closed on a handful of piled dreadlocks. Before he could jerk down and drive the general to his knees, the matted coils of hair slipped out of his grasp like so much greased rope as Modo backed away into the nothingness. The Governor General was in no mood to stand and fight, but he had no choice. Help was not coming soon enough. Ryan felt Chucho squeeze his wrist hard, a warning. As the next backhand slashed, Ryan's lookalike struck with his nunchuck, tangling up the sword. Modo tried to free his saber from the temporary trap. Ryan lunged forward and grabbed himself a handful of golden epaulet. He drove his shoulder into the center of the general's chest. Both men slammed into a broken section of wall on the ground. Phantom stars blazed in Ryan's vision as he slumped to the floor, dragging Chucho to his knees as well.
Chucho, let go of my wrist.
Ryan grabbed the free end of the manacle chain he held. Then he pulled it up past the exposed throat and over the hideous face. He could feel the chain links scraping against the golden fangs. Ryan jerked back hard, yanking the manacles into the corners of the Governor General's mouth like a horse's bridle. Jamming a knee in the middle of the man's spine, Ryan leaned back, applying pressure to the jaw hinges. Moto bucked and writhed, trying to claw backward to reach Ryan's surviving eye.
Oh, are you choking him to death? Oh, I wish I could see.
Choking is too good for him. This is for the boy you had butchered on the church steps, you piece of shit.
Ryan twisted the chain into a knot behind the Governor General's head.
For Godwood! For Godwood Reed!
He rammed the man's face into the limestone wall again and again. In disgust, Ryan hurled down the ragdoll corpse. As he pushed back from it, his hand brushed the saber Moto had dropped. He picked it up as he rose to his feet. Groping in the dark, he tried to find his lookalike.
Here, Chucho. Take his blade.
Ryan dropped hard to his knees. A blast of rock dust swept over Ryan as the ceiling caved in. He tried to move his legs and couldn't. Something heavy had fallen across them just above the knees. He reached down and felt the slab of limestone that held him pinned. He tried to move the rock, but it wouldn't budge. The saber had fallen somewhere in the dark, so he couldn't use it to get leverage.
Chucho! Chucho!
Are you okay?
Chucho!
Ryan felt a slight breeze across his cheek. He smelled fresh air, which could only mean an exit to the outside had been opened, either the main door or a breach in the perimeter wall caused by the explosion. He wasn't the only one who felt the wind and understood what it meant. He sensed the Red Sash and Priest survivor stumbling around, turning face first into the breeze, following it to find a way out.
What the fuck is going on?
Ryan stopped struggling to free himself, a wide smile spreading across his face.
Tom! Tom! This way!
A tiny glow appeared in the center of the all-encompassing blackness. It seemed to be a long ways off, but Ryan knew the distance could have been an illusion in the absence of landmarks. The dim light approached, bobbing up and down. It was so faint it didn't illuminate the sides or ceiling of the corridor. That was because of all the dust in the air. As it got closer, a tightly focused beam grew brighter. It speared through the dark, spotlighting a half-naked man sitting on the rock and body-littered floor about 30 feet away from where Ryan lay trapped.
Ryan?
Wrong twin, Tom. That's Chucho. I'm over here. Can't move my legs out from under this rock.
The light turned and pinpointed him. He shielded his good eye from the glare with a hand. The light turned back to Chucho. On the other side of the hallway, the double quickly rose to his feet, his manacle nunchucks cocked back.
Ryan, do you know this man?
Hell yes, he knows me. I've come to break both of you out of this shit pit. Help me get the rock off him so I can finish the job.
Together, the three of them shifted the slab. As Ryan tested his legs for injuries, Tom set his duffel bag on the floor. From it, he took two headlamps, which he gave to Ryan and Chucho. As they adjusted the straps, he dug out a pair of beat-up Argentine knockoff 45 caliber blasters. In the light of his headlamp, Ryan checked the pistol's mag and then eased back the slide until he saw brass to make sure a live round was chambered.
Now let's go surprise the others. Can't wait to see the looks on their faces when I waltz up, big as life.
Christy, Mildred, Doc, JB, and Jack were separated from the rest of the galley slaves and marched onto a black ship that was docked at the fort last night. They've been gone almost 24 hours now. Let's get out of here. We're wasting precious time.
I have to do something first.
Ryan and Tom watched as Chucho returned to his cell, took a set of keys from the belt of a dead Red Sash, and walked down the hallway. He unlocked the next cell in the row, freeing the man inside. He whispered in the man's ear, first handing him the ring of keys, then giving him his headlamp. The man nodded enthusiastically, pulled on the light and hurried off into the dark. Chucho threw back his head.
¡Libertad, mis hermanos! ¡Libertad para nosotros todo!
When the lookalike returned to Ryan's side, he smiled.
I told our neighbor it was his duty to let all our brothers go free, and to tell them that it was their duty not to live their restored lives in vain, but to take back what has been stolen.
There they go. We need to get as well. This way.
The three men headed toward the exit, side by side, blasters at the ready. Ryan's spotlight picked up crumpled human forms at the foot of the wall, forms in red robes. The ring of illumination played over what was left of Itzamna, the spider priest. His cone hat and blood veil had gone missing, and half of the top of the right side of his head was blown off, from mid-crown to temple. The farther they advanced toward the exit, the less dust there was. By the time they reached the anteroom, the air had cleared. As they headed for the doorless portal, Ryan paused.
What about Red Sash reinforcements coming across the bridge?
The bridge of the last sigh.
It's gone. I dropped the far end of the bridge in the water when I blew off the door. The men in the fort will have to swim across the channel to help out. And they won't do that because they don't have a clue what's going on. I made sure none of the prison guards got out alive.
But they can still shoot at us across the gap.
Shut off your headlamp. I've got the dinghy tied up and waiting outside. Don't make any noise. We need to scoot out of here without attracting attention to ourselves.
With that, the traitor led the way, slipping out the front entrance. Ryan followed close on his heels and felt the fresh salt air hit his face. The combustion lanterns scattered here and there along the fort's ramparts glowed pale yellow. They didn't throw a strong enough light to expose the channel or the prison island's key. No more than 5 minutes had passed since the explosions at the bridge and prison portal. Ryan could sense the chaos on the battlements. Lanterns were hurried back and forth. The militiamen were afraid of more demolition on the perimeter. They wanted to keep out of the line of fire. This made defending the walls a challenge. Chucho, Ryan, and Tom hustled into the dinghy. Tom pushed off the bow, and then the men hopped in. The little boat drifted in the dark while the traitor picked up the oars. Carefully, he turned the dinghy and then began to row for the end of the channel. As the tiny boat slid out of the channel and into the protected finger of the bay, Tom rowed harder, really putting his back into it. He only eased off after they had reached the quay and the tied-up vessels on the opposite side. Rounding the corner, putting the pier and the boats between them and the fort's line of sight, Tom looked at Ryan.
Put on your headlamp for a second. Keep me on course. Don't want to run into anything.
Ryan flicked on his lamp, lighting up a narrow strip of black water off the bow.
Veer port three strokes, then straighten out.
He shut off the lamp as Tom kept rowing. Ryan flicked the lamp on again, just in time to see the familiar bulk of the Tempest. She sat moored broadside to them, dead ahead. Ryan shut off the light.
Almost there.
When they got close, Tom shipped his oars and let the dinghy glide up alongside the hull. They hooked the dinghy to the davit cables and one by one climbed aboard Tempest amidships. Only when all three were on deck was the trap sprung.
Put down your guns, Deathlanders!
A lantern suddenly appeared at their feet, its light-proof cover pulled off, apparently by a hidden cord. The weak glow illuminated the three boarders, but little else.
You're outnumbered. Put down your guns on the deck and your hands on top of your heads.
How do we know you're not bluffing?
Four other shielded lanterns flared in the darkness. In the additional light, Ryan could see that there were three Red Sashes hunkered down in the cockpit, and three others crouched on the far side of the cabin. All of them held blasters, braced and leveled.
It's all right. Let's do as he says. Don't worry. Got this deal covered.
Ryan couldn't see how that was possible. But the traitor had gotten them this far, against worse odds. Besides, the only other options were bad and worse. A one-sided gun battle, or a late-night swim leaking blood from a dozen buckshot holes. When Harmonica Tom put down his submachine gun and revolver, Ryan did the same. Chucho reluctantly followed suit. The leader of the Red Sash boarding party stood in the cockpit. The others remained behind cover, with their weapons trained.
Now, put your hands on your head and walk this way.
They did as they were told, and the Red Sash stopped them short of the cockpit, then reached down to the deck and uncovered a shape hidden by a canvas tarp. To make sure they could see what lay there, he picked up the lantern from the companionway roof and held it close. Ryan recognized the remains of a human corpse. It had been savagely mauled, gutted from gullet to goobers, arms chewed down to the bare bones, leg bones gnawed off and ragged stumps at the knees. The still wet crimson sash over its shoulder looked almost black in the lantern light.
God damn it. It's Bob.
Who?
Bob to the surface. The red sash I chilled to get these fancy-ass threads. I sank his body with a couple of concrete blocks yesterday. Before the lights went out, he must have popped up. Somebody found what was left of him. Maybe even these triple stoops.
Silencio! You're going back to prison. And I and my men will get a big, fat reward.
The leader jabbed his double barrel at them for emphasis.
Oh, yeah? Well, there's an even bigger reward waiting for you and your compadres below decks in the cabin. You probably don't want to have to share it with the priests. You can have it all to yourselves if you let us go. I'll unlock the companionway door for you.
The leader thought on this for a moment, and then stepped back, waving Tom forward and down into the cockpit with him. As the traitor unlocked the padlock on its hasp, he shot a hidden wink at Ryan, who instantly tensed. Tom lifted off the lock and put it in his pocket. He took hold of the door and opened it halfway, then paused. Impatient to get on with it, the leader grabbed him by the shoulder and shoved him out of the cockpit, back beside Ryan and Chucho. Eager to see what the big prize was, the other red sashes rose from cover and moved aft. The leader glanced back.
You two men, keep the prisoners in your gun sights.
Picking up the lantern from the deck, the leader threw back the door all the way. Ryan, Chucho, and Tom jumped the remaining two very surprised red sashes.
Cast off! Cast off! There's no way we're gonna sneak out of here now.
Ryan made for the bow. Chucho untied the stern. Tempest's engine rumbled to life. Tom backed the sloop away from the pier, spinning the helm hard over.
Ryan, I need you back here. Chucho, throw those goddamn lanterns over the side. Do it quick.
When Ryan jumped down into the cockpit, Tom hit the cabin's light switch.
Go below, disconnect the tripwire from the PKM, then reload it. There's a couple of 100-round magazines on the galley table. Bring the weapon and extra mag up here. We need to put the sting back in Tempest's tail.
Ryan quickly did as he was told. Tom shut off the cabin lights the moment he appeared on deck.
Use your headlamp to mount the blaster, then shut it off.
Outside, Tempest was sliding through inky blackness. Behind him, as Ryan fitted the PKM into its swivel rail mount, he could see the dim lights along the fort's ramparts and brighter wag, head, and tail lights moving between the fort and Veracruz, but the going directly ahead was almost as pitch dark as it had been in the prison. The overcast skies had reduced visibility to practically nothing. The green beacon light that marked the entrance had been extinguished. Tom was sailing by the seat of his pants. After he'd locked the heavy blaster in place on the stern rail, Ryan turned off the headlamp. High over the harbor, a quartet of red signal flares burst, one after another. As they slowly descended, they cast enough light for Ryan to see 100 yards or more ahead. They cast enough light for the fort gunners to see the sloop making for the end of the peninsula and the open sea.
Fuck!
The fort's cannons blasted the night. The volley of shells plowed into the sea well ahead and behind them, detonating with stunning force and sending plumes of smoke and water and red-hot shrapnel skyward.
They're bracketing us, trying to lock in the range. Give them a taste of the MG, Ryan.
If the flare's light exposed Tempest to the fort's fire, it also exposed the fort to Ryan. He shouldered the PKM and strafed the ancient battlements with steel-jacketed rounds. Every 10th round in the mag was a tracer, which made it easy for him to track his bullet fall. It wasn't precision work, though. Not without a telescope. Not without a fully illuminated target. He walked auto-fire up the walls to zero in on the gun emplacements. Cannon rounds landed close on either side of the ship, blowing foaming divots in the black water, so close that Ryan felt the hell gust of their explosions. As Ryan reloaded the PKM, Tom took evasive action.
Keep your heads down!
He cut the helm hard to starboard. He wasn't giving the red sash gunners an easy broadside to hit. Although he ran a zigzag evasive course, he kept the smallest possible target, the stern, facing their muzzles. Ryan racked the PKM's actuator, chambering the first round in the box mag. He noticed there were no ships in pursuit, at least not yet. He put the lack of response down to the general disarray and confusion from the blackout and the dispersal of Red Sashes and Mattachine forces along the execution parade route. Between the booms of the cannon, he noticed sporadic small arms fire coming from downtown Veracruz. It sounded like the good citizens were rising up, and the Red Sashes were burning ammo to fight them off. Another reason they weren't being chased. When the second round of flares winked out in the sea, darkness closed in, but Harmonica Tom already had his compass heading. As they cleared the bay's entrance, they met a breeze hard from the north, gusting steadily, and a 3-foot running chop. A third volley of flares lit up the bay.
Take the helm, Ryan. Put the wind behind us while I get the sails raised.
One final desperate cannon shot, lobbed extra high, came whistling down. One lonely miss, exploding some 200 yards short. Tempest scooted away into the blackness.